It's a good machine. Yeah, testing 1, 2, 3, 4. Testing 1, 2, 3, 4. So finally, we get my closest friend, Reverend Miller, the Episcopal Church on Broad Street, you know, right near our temple. And he came to the meeting, and what did he do? He offered a prayer that God should straighten out the thinking of Hitler because he's sick. And we hope that if God will straighten him out, then all the troubles will be over. And the people were terribly let down. It was a very bad feeling. But the meeting was a very great success because it couldn't be ignored in the press. And the place was packed and the feeling was high. And that's really when people began to feel the impact of the Holocaust.
You felt then that during that period the newspapers were hostile and you could not get...
I wouldn't say hostile.
Just
they were afraid. Because they have connections with their advertisers, and anything that advertises them, like, as you know, cannot get into the papers.
Rabbi
Harburg, do you recall the incident with the boat with the 700, 900 German refugees who came to Cuba? It was in 1939, and they wouldn't let them in, and they sailed the coast of Florida, and they still wouldn't let them in. They had to go back. Do you recall whether there was any protest on that?
No.
Land?
No.
No, there wasn't any.
At that time, you see, yeah, we didn't have yet television, and we weren't so keenly aware of everything that was taking place in the world. We did know what was happening in New York, and or in Boston, or in Lynn, or in Israel, because we had very good connections with Israel because of the fact that every 3 months or so, some prominent person from Palestine would come to appeal for money, and so we got quite a bit of information.
I might interject to say that meeting that you're talking about, my name was on one of the sponsors.
Well, it was good.
I just read it in the paper the other day. It wasn't real. I wasn't aware of that.
I regret to say that the people who were the pillars of the synagogues, the temples at that time, were not too enthusiastic about that meeting, and they came, some of them, I wouldn't say some, a lot of them came, but didn't participate in any active way. There was a fear, because it's the old story of Jesus Christus, so Edelzer.
Well put,
huh?
That's well put.
That's what it is to...
Did you get it?
I think I have it just...
Yeah.
That the way Christians feel about things, we feel just like... I met a fellow who just started out as an accountant. He's working for some company in a very low position here. But he's very anti-Kennedy because he's altogether too liberal, and he wants to spend too much money on social programs, and spoke with great animosity towards Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he listens to the bosses, and he knows exactly what's right and wrong.
Were the rabbis in this area, how many rabbis were there at that time?
There were only about two or three at the time, but I was the only English-speaking rabbi at the time, and so that whenever anything happened in the community, whether they were communists or laborers or Yiddishes. As a matter of fact, I was even suspected by many of the pillars of my congregation and sisterhood that I'm sort of pinkish, because I would see me sometimes in company with Yiddish labor people. You know, we had quite a strong labor movement here. We had our own headquarters on Summer Street, and I can tell you that they used to bring down some of the outstanding speakers. You talk about having little money. They had very little money, and they have a banquet with herring, bread, and tea, and cake, but they'll bring down the poets and writers of great stature. And I used to go to those meetings, and some of our people didn't like it at all. It just didn't.
Now the temples, some of them, are sponsoring the Russian emigres here, the temples themselves, like Rabbi Bennett has six from Temple Beth El.
But you see, there's a difference. When you say sponsoring, which is a very correct term, we only offer hospitality, personal concern. We extend invitations to them. One of our women had four Russian Jews for the Seder and Passover. But the bulk of the work is being done, as we know, by the social service and financed by the Federation to the tune of about $3,500 a year.
Now, what is the counterpart of that during the 1930s?
We didn't have it. You know, whatever was done, it was done unofficially. One of our members would invite a German Jew for kiddush or for Passover. But it was done just informally.
So there was no organized work done.
You see, you must bear in mind that at that time, most of our Jewish people, with the exception maybe of a couple hundred, were just struggling themselves. Not only financially, but they had to put through their children's school, and they had quite a pretty rough time during the Depression. There were people who were contemplating suicide. I mean, literally.
Yeah.
And I met up with such people. So you can't compare the atmosphere of the 30s to the 60s. Now we are quite an affluent community.
In Boston, the Jewish Vocational Service did help to try to get jobs for some of the people who came in the 30s and the 40s.
But Boston Jewry was already a highly organized community. You must bear in mind that community in Lynn started around just about 1890 or so. In fact, I knew intimately the man who was secretary, first secretary of the first Jewish organization.
Yeah, Mr. Lippman.
Yeah.
Dr. Ellis Michelson's father. Uh-huh.
The daughter of Mr. Lippman is still alive. He was 17 years old. He was the only one who could write in English and in Yiddish. So they elected him as secretary for this, the first cemetery that was organized. So that and even when I came here in 28, most of our people were either small storekeepers, workers. There's a lot of shoe people here, little tailoring shops. So you can't compare it with the present day
atmosphere where we have in active members in the Federation who are doctors and lawyers and dentists and accountants. But in spite of it all, a great deal was done. We had people, for instance, who would call up and say they didn't have any money to buy coal or oil. See, they didn't have all the advantages that poor people have today. So I'd call up people like old man Jacobs, if you remember.
Jacobs.
Even old man Eigner, elderly men who had already had some means, and they would call up the coal company or the oil company, tell them to send up coal or oil, and charge it up to them. I mean, that's the way we operated. There was no organization.
Would you just recount the people who were most active at that time in terms of concern about the German refugees?
Well, I would say that the only one who was really concerned was William Norton. There were many who had given money because they couldn't refuse it. But I wouldn't say that any of them were truly active.
Well, you were active.
Well, I'm not counting myself on speaking about the people.
Yeah.
I will say this, that one of the reasons for it was that the few people who were active and who had some means were so involved with the work for the Jews in Palestine and with the immigration to Palestine that any other activity was to them a diversion from what they considered a real Jewish obligation.
I know this is very difficult, but what is your understanding of the prevailing view in the Jewish community as to what was happening in Europe to the Jews? How intimately did they know? What view did they have?
The only thing they knew was that what they read in the newspaper, or of the men who used to come here. We used to have people like Maurice Samuel. You heard of him?
Yes, of course.
And Abe Goldberg is a very famous Zionist speaker. Pierre von Pastor, who was truly Jewish in every way. And Ishmael Levin would come here. It's one thing about Lynn, and that is that despite the fact that we were a very poor community and a very limited community, we had the advantage of having some of the greatest speakers, even Chaim Weizmann was here, and Nachum Sokolov. This is a picture over there. Nachum Sokolov is considered the king, the uncrowned king of the Jewish people. And the reason for it was that Henry Ozel was very active Zionist, the most effective money raiser in this community at that time. Had his business in Boston. With his connections there, he was able to get every great speaker that came to Boston to come to Lynn.
Where did they speak when they came to Lynn?
Well, either in the center or in the Temple Beth El.
And how many people would you say came to one of those meetings?
Well, we had fairly good attendances. Hadassah was very active in that too. That is, aside from being interested in Hadassah. Hadassah at that time was almost like a sisterhood to a temple. They took a very active part in Zionist work for Israel and did a lot of calling, doing anything that they could. In fact, they did a lot of communal work. In fact, I was so close to them that I'm saying this not to boast about. They inscribed my name in the Golden Book in Jerusalem, even though they had limited funds, and they planted 400 trees in the Jewish National Park in my honor. To this very day, they feel as if I have a second sisterhood. In fact, some of them still remember those days.
So what you really are saying is that to the extent that this poor community projected beyond itself, beyond its own immediate concerns, the thrust of that was toward Zionism and the movement toward Palestine.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, this has been a great struggle in Federation meetings to this very day. In that we had all along men in the Federation who felt that anything less than 75% the Federation money going to Israel is a misrepresentation of the whole UJ movement. And to this day, we have about 60% still going to Israel. And of course, see, Israel at that time was not the Israel today. Today, Israel is talking about millions and billions of dollars in their budgets. But the situation in Israel was such that a man like Klum, you know who I mean?
The showman.
He died.
Yeah, he died recently.
He was at that time, had a factory in Maine. Yeah. And he got a few people to ship a whole load of Maine potatoes to Israel. There was just plain need of food. And of course, at that time, Hadassah was really a great provider of medical service. Because today you have very big hospitals in Israel that surpassed anything that Hadassah could even think of. But in those days, it was a struggle. I was in Israel in 35, I was in Israel in 47, and I could actually see what was happening there, and the persecution, and the underground. I'm sure you're familiar with it. I met later on that people who were in prison or sent to labor camps out in the Sinai Desert. So that touched the people more than the problems of a few German Jews. So you have to get the...
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to do, is get the perspective.
The atmosphere.
Yeah.
But the same thing happened, if you remember, in 74, right after the during the Yom Kippur War, a meeting was held at Temple Israel to raise some money. And there weren't enough seats. People were standing around the walls. And thousands of dollars came in. And they had several women to keep a record. They couldn't write fast enough. And we did two things. This is just petty. See, the bond organization was competing with the UK,
so
they had two different drives, but finally we ironed out the differences, and we said we're going to do both. And people that I didn't think had any kind of money gave $10,000.
I was at that meeting, it was very exciting.
It was an exciting meeting. As a matter of fact, they had some speakers there, and people were bored with them because they were just waiting for the speakers to get through because they all came to give money.
Right.
It was a fantastic display of loyalty.
Yeah.
And this, in a way, was in a way good, too, because the people in Israel became so prejudiced that they thought that American Jews don't feel their plight as strongly as they should. but after this 74 I experienced it, because what happened in Lynn happened all over the country,
right.
All over the world.
Right.
My brother-in-law was in England at that time, and he's a rabbi, and he was invited for a year to replace a man who was sick, and he was in Manchester, and he told me that women came and brought their jewelry to be sold to send to Israel. I mean, that's how strongly they felt.
And Rabbi Harber, excuse me,
yeah.
Going back to 39, you may not recall this, but I read it in the paper when I was checking the Lynn item. You were involved with an affair, what I call the affair of the Nazi books. I don't remember that.
You mean there was a book
that was going to be given to the public schools in Lynn here?
Yeah.
That was given by Hitler, I guess. And there was quite a lot of protest in the city, and you gave a statement on that, and it was in the paper. Do you recall that?
I have a very big recollection.
Gotcha. It's on the record. He was a good anti-Nazi fighter.
Well, there's one thing.
The only one in the city on the other side of the tracks.
this is one of the things that was held against me, that I was too much on the other side of the track.
because
I got more cooperation
from
the Yiddish-speaking labor people.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, we had one woman in our sister who was very articulate, and she said that Rabbi Harber is really getting men under false pretense, because he supposedly works for Rabbi Gadel, but in reality, he spends more time in the Lynn Hebrew school and in the Yiddish school. And the labor group and he's seen it at Hunt's. I used to meet some of the communists at Hunt's, and when they came in, they have a cup of coffee. Because you don't remember Hunt's.
Yeah.
What is Hunt's?
It was a restaurant, a popular restaurant downtown.
This was the most popular restaurant.
Yeah. Downtown in Lynn?
In the square, yeah.
It's like G&G.
G&G.
It was open 24 hours a day.
Right.
And when they came in there, and saw me at a round table with six or seven communists, they really thought that I was really getting money under false pretense.
Right.
But as difficult as it was, though, it was a very trying and interesting period, challenging. And we did it all with very little money. You see, this is when Rabin came here for a meeting. I think Furman spent about $1,300 advertising the meeting. All we did when Chaim Weizmann came here was to put in a little ad in the item and in the Telegram news. You don't remember that too. We had another paper called here, Telegram News.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't have any money in the treasury, but the Zionists used to meet at a restaurant, and we just, each one chipped in some money.
Yeah.
And so we had enough money to advertise it, and we had a very outstanding meeting with Chaim Weizmann.
And I remember that.
And see, we did, in a way, in fact, I spoke on that before the Federation a couple of years ago in connection with the eulogy that I gave to Addis, Hyman Addis.
Hyman Addis.
Because he was one of the group.
Yeah.
And I said that even though we were a small community, but a few people of any means, we were able to get outstanding personalities, and we did a lot of work. As a matter of fact, Lynn was considered one of the most Zionistic communities.
Can I just ask a question? I'm rather interested. Were there any unaccompanied children
among
German refugees? did they send, I know it was not uncommon in Europe to send children out of the cities and into the country. And I know growing up as a small child, there were single orphan children sent to Boston. And I wondered if there were any unaccompanied children who were sent here.
They didn't have any. As a matter of fact, most of the German Jews that came here were already middle-aged people. There were few, like Liebelis, who had children of school age.
Why was that?
Huh?
The
reason for it is that we were a little bit selfish. You see, all these people were handled by Hayas in New York. And we always told the Hayas people to send us the kind of people that we could find employment for them. And most of those that came here to do work in the shoe factories or in the letter shops in Peabody were people of already middle age. And I say middle age, I mean between 45 and 60 or something.
So there weren't any children?
We didn't have that problem. Mm-hmm. I suppose in Boston they had. Of course, we always worked together with the Boston office. This is another complaint that they had against me, was that I spent too much time in Boston because I was president of the Rabbinical Association there. I was one of the leaders of the founders of the Associate Synagogue on Tremont Street. Was chairman of the Kashrut Committee there. I almost lost my faith in Judaism and this job. Really, this was the most trying thing of all. But I spent a great deal of time in Boston so that I had contact with them whenever we had problems that we couldn't handle there. But we didn't have any problems with children.
There weren't any children that came here unaccompanied that I can recall. Many of the families, people who came here single. They left a wife there or a betrothed there. And they came here hoping to bring them afterwards. And it wasn't until 39 when it was shut off.
Well, we had a few that had their children going to temple religious school.
Yes.
In fact, some of them were confirmed. Affirmance of Temple Bethel religious school, but they have adjusted themselves very well, and these people are all synagogue-minded people. I mean,
yes,
they were not strangers to us.
Yeah. Right.
Are we talking about 100 or 200? Huh? Are we talking about 100 or 200 or
2 dozen?
2 dozen. That's what I want to get clear.
That's all
we're talking about.
Up to 39.
That
we have records of.
Yeah.
You see,
2 dozen people or 2 dozen families?
2 dozen people. Maybe half a dozen families.
In 39, we had a singer that came to one of our meetings. And they engaged her to go out to sing on different Jewish occasions. And she was so completely Judaized that she was one of the last people to leave Germany. And I talked to her, and she had no feeling that she was Jewish. It was simply imposed upon her. I mean, that's how strange they were.
Yes. Yeah.
And some of them didn't want to accept their status as Jews. You see, fortunately, in Russia, whether a person wants it or not, he has stamped on his identification card, Yevrei, which means in Russian, Hebrew. So that whenever they, even to this day, whenever they come into a library or they look for a job, whatever they do, they have to show their identification card, and it hurts them
to identify themselves as Jews, but they have to. The assimilation in Russia is very, very strong. But on the other hand, Dr. Valensky, who is professor of the Hebrew College. I speak with him about once or twice a week on the phone. He went to Russia to do some research work on Hasidism. In fact, I have his books here. And he had to have some manuscripts that only Russia had, and they wouldn't send it out or even make a zero copy of it. So he came into the biggest library in Leningrad, and he was met by a very tall, impressive-looking man with a typical Russian name, and he spoke to him in Hebrew, in very fluent Hebrew. So Valensky actually became curious. Now the story is that his mother was Jewish, and her father was a great Hebraist, and he taught him as a child Hebrew, and then when he went to college, he took up a course of Semitics, because Hebrew was